It's the basement.
Hello and welcome. You are listening to It's Debatable on Campus FM 103.7. I am Darren Katkuti and I'm going to be your host for today. Every week, students from the Department of International Relations have been meeting up in this studio and we have been discussing hot topics from the current affairs scenario. Our topic for today deals with the integration of the member states of the European Union. Present here in the studios to discuss this topic with me for today, I have Christian Tanti and Stefan Darmanin, second year international relations students. Welcome back. On today's show of It's Debatable, we shall be exploring what constraints and what triggers the EU integration process. Remember that you can join our conversation with your questions and comments by sending an email on info@mirsa.org.mt or by logging on our online forum on mirsa.org.mt. Joining me now is our academic contributor for today, Ms. Valentina Kassar, who lectures in Security Studies and Foreign Policy at the University of Malta, and the second year international relations students, Christian Tanti and Stefan Darmanin. I welcome you all to It's Debatable.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Kassar, let me start with you.
First of all, I would like to start with this reality, sort of when the European states emerged out of the Second World War, sort of Europe was devastated and the European states wanted to do something about their future prospects and they resorted to this concept of European integration. But how did they go about it?
So the idea of a united Europe had long persisted throughout European history. However, it was only after the devastation of the Second World War and within the context of the Cold War that was emerging that the climate was right for European integration to begin and for statesmen to acknowledge the benefits that this could bring with it. So by 1951, you had the six founding members who signed the Treaty of Paris, which established the European Coal and Steel Community. And the preamble to this treaty sheds light on the principles and objectives that the founding members sought to uphold. And these are still principles that resonate very strongly today within the European Union. They highlighted the contribution that an organized Europe could make to international stability by overcoming the age-old rivalries that had characterized their previous relations, and they also recognized that unity could only be built through practical achievements and in a step-by-step manner. A couple of years later, in 1957, the six went on to sign the Treaties of Rome, and here they established the European Economic Community and the Euratom. And here we really see the long-term vision that they sought to achieve, when they stated that they were determined to lay the foundations of an ever closer union among the peoples of Europe.
At first we had the European Coal and Steel Community, but throughout the past six decades, sort of the process of European integration has evolved and we now have a European Union of 27 member states. What can you tell us about this, especially with regards to this widening of the European Union?
So the process of integration has evolved remarkably and it's widened and deepened to both the membership and the agenda that would probably have been unimaginable to the founding fathers in the 1950s. Its membership has increased from 6 to 27 states, as you said, and the largest intake took place in 2004, and this was only made possible by the end of the Cold War and the removal of the metaphorical Iron Curtain that had divided the European continent for so long. Now, in parallel with its widening across the continent, the process of integration also widened in its areas of competence, and the EEC increased its agenda to include agriculture, fisheries, environmental issues, economic and monetary union, to name just a few of the issues. It involves itself in. The widening was also complemented by a deepening of the integration process and a number of institutional changes that were made possible by a series of treaties that accommodated not only the expansion of the agenda, but also the number and the membership of states that formed part of the Union or the Community at the time. Perhaps one of the most notable was the 1992 treaty, and this renamed, in fact it's called the Treaty of European Union, and this renamed the integration process into a union rather than a community. And here you have the economic community being complemented by two further pillars, which were justice and home affairs and common foreign security policy.
Also, I noticed that most recently, in 2009, we had the Lisbon Treaty, which came into effect as well.
Exactly, the most recent was the Lisbon Treaty, and this served as a consolidation, you could say, of the previous treaties in an attempt to make the Union both more efficient, but as well as better equipped to deal with its role and responsibilities, not just internally and within the Union itself, but even at an international level and amongst or in the context of rather the global challenges and issues that it might be faced by.
When we speak of this whole integration process, as you said, there might be challenges, but there are also maybe major accomplishments. Can you comment about this too?
Mm-hmm. I mean, speaking about the Lisbon Treaty, that was probably one of the biggest, one of the best examples of challenges that the Union has faced, or the types of challenges that it faces in upholding this dismantle and objective of ever closer union. It was seen as a setback to the and a compromise to the constitution that it had originally sought to achieve and had worked towards over the previous years. However, this example of disagreement was not the first stumbling block, and it definitely will not be the last that the union will face. For example, in the past we've seen challenges in the early years of integration with regards to achieving a political and defence community alongside the economic community that it was so successful in. With regards to enlargement, we saw the French President Charles de Gaulle originally objecting to Britain's membership.
And we also had, with regards to monetary affairs, the introduction of the euro, which was a major accomplishment, but I guess it was also a challenge for the European Union.
Exactly, because it had taken almost two decades for them to agree in the way in which this should take place. And even then you have member states who opted out of this area of integration, along with other areas of integration, such as the Schengen Agreement. As well, we've seen the member states still facing difficulties in the extent to which they are able to speak with one voice at an international level, particularly when it comes to very sensitive and major issues on the world stage. But this obviously doesn't mean that the challenges have not brought with them accomplishments as well. Member states, first of all, have continued to uphold this notion of ever closer union. And at the same time, whilst its agenda and its remit has expanded quite successfully over the past six decades, you've also seen the Union bringing itself, or trying to bring itself, closer to the citizens and being at the service of the citizens. And it's done this both through more direct public engagement in the decision-making processes, but even by trying to, or making the benefits of the Union more tangible for the citizens.
Well, we had failures, we had accomplishments as well in our integration process. But what lessons can be learned when we talk of these experiences, and how may they be applied to the issues which we currently face today as the European Union?
I think one of the most important lessons we can take from all this is the resilience of the European Union. The fact that its members have learned to overcome the challenges and disagreements that they are faced by, and they've succeeded in keeping the integration process on track despite the setbacks and near derailments that they've been faced with. And in doing so, I think they have time and again proved wrong those who speculate over the possible disintegration and failings of the European Union.
I thank you very much, Ms. Kassar. Ms. Valentina Kassar is a lecturer in foreign policy at the University of Malta, and we hope to speak to you again some other time on It's Debatable. And the debate now continues with our other two guests for today, Stefan Darmanin and Christian Tanti, and we shall be looking at the process of European integration, also from other approaches, especially the environmental challenges and challenges with regards to foreign policy, which the integration process faces today.
Thank you for joining us with that introduction, Ms. Kassar. The debate on the EU integration process now continues in the studios with my other two guests for today, Christian and Stefan. I know that you have researched about the major constraints for which the European integration process faces. Can you explain to our listeners how these came about?
Well, basically, though, the idea of integration has long been established. European integration, I think, is still quite limited at the economic level. At the political level, European integration is still quite constrained because of a number of factors. For example, the most visible factor is the fact that the nation state still remain the primary actor. Although in recent years, extensive areas of policy have been transferred from nation states' jurisdiction towards supranational authorities, other fundamental areas like foreign policy still rest primarily under the jurisdiction of the nation state. Not even the introduction of the high representative post since the Lisbon Treaty came into force. This didn't transfer foreign policy as the exclusive jurisdiction of the European Union, but it remained under the nation state. Legislation, for example, with regards to high politics, is passed through negotiated agreements between nation states, hence in an intergovernmental manner. But even in various other legislations, there is flexibility for nation state to postpone implementation of certain legislation. There is still not even any autonomous agencies overseeing the implementation of certain legislation by the nation states.
Christian, I see that you have something to add to what Stefan is saying over here about the how these process and constraints came about.
Yes, basically, I agree with your argument, the fact that sometimes in foreign policymaking, states still are the primary actors. However, eventually, especially within the context of interdependence nowadays, where states are so dependent on each other more than before, even at the economic level, it will eventually spill over to the political level, but one can say that this process is still in the process, so one has to wait to see the effects, the outcomes, will they be.
Okay, Christian, how can EU integration improve relations between the member states?
Yes, basically, apart from the various policies the EU takes to improve even better relations between member states. One can mention, for example, the policy of Schengen, the Schengen agreement between member states of the EU, which basically allows free movement of people and also allows makes place for free trade to take place between these member states, which eventually, as you said, will establish better relations between member states in the EU, in the European Union.
I also know that there is a great difference between the populistic level and the supranational nature of the European Union. How do these interact between each other?
Well, basically, I think European integration is hindered basically by a crisis of identity. The European political system, I think, lacks a political community with common traditions and expectations. However, I think one cannot compare the difference between regions. For example, in northwestern Europe there are more resources, and in southern Europe and in eastern Europe there are less resources, so you cannot expect the citizens of both regions to have the same expectations. Hence, the people would see the European Union in a way as representing the interests of the ambitious elites who work there, not the people per se. The European Union, although try to address this problem by expanding the powers of the European Parliament with regards to the budget, and since 1986, since the Single European Act, there was the introduction of the co-decision procedure, where European Parliament shares equal power with the Council over various legislations. Basically, however, positive results still are not forthcoming, because in every European Parliament election since 1979, I think citizen participation continued to decline, which epitomizes how there is a whole difference between citizen expectations and European actual governance.
Christian, you have something to say about this?
Yes, first, okay, I agree with you, Paul, when you mentioned the fact that participation among people in about EU elections is declining. Okay, I agree with you there. But still, I disagree with you where you mentioned the lack of political culture between the citizens. In my opinion, I think most of the EU citizens have a lot in common in terms of political culture. And an example of this can be the fact that every state, every member state, including its citizens, all of them aspire towards democratic governance. Their expectation towards a democratic governance is present in every member state. Also, apart from this, even certain values that are common between every member state. If we have, for example, take a look at the Copenhagen criteria, one can find that there are certain clauses which are basically all member states agreed upon to, which shows that there is political culture the same between every member state, which is common between them. So that's why I kind of disagree with your point there.
Those were my guests for today, Christian Tanti and Stefan Darmanin. We're discussing the process of EU integration. I thank you all for your input so far. We'll have to stop for a short break. I invite our listeners to keep listening to It's Debatable on Campus FM. Coming up is our special guest, Dr. Vanish Wirep, head of music, who will be sharing with us his knowledge about the subject we're discussing today, EU integration. Stay tuned and keep listening. Welcome back, our listeners. You are listening to It's Debatable on Campus FM frequency 103.7. I am Darren Katkuti and I am your host for today's show. Remember that you can join our debate. We're discussing the process of EU integration today by posting your questions and comments on our online forum, mirsa.org.mt. Joining us now is our special guest for today, Dr. Vanish Wirep, who heads the Malta EU Steering and Action Committee, commonly referred to as MUSEC. Dr. Wirep, before the break, our two students in the studios were discussing the process of EU integration. I ask you, is there a European way to integration, or is it simply about intercultural dialogue and mutual respect?
When the European Union was founded, initially it was founded as a European Coal and Steel Community, and this was back in the 50s. Eventually, the coal and steel community was extended to become an economic community, which is now, of course, the European Union. Well, when this process started, it was intended to bring together the countries, at the time, the countries of Western Europe, in order to try and secure peace among nations that had been for centuries at war with each other, in particular France and Germany. So there was this idea that by bringing together these countries and by establishing a community having institutions that act in their own name on behalf of the community and not simply as the collectivity of the member states, this would allow the process of peace to be extended to become very much ingrained in the not only in the mentality of the leaders of those countries, of those nations. Initially, as we know, there were six, so we're talking of France, Germany, Italy, and the three Benelux, Holland, the Netherlands, that is Belgium and Luxembourg. Well, the idea was for these countries to pool together their resources and subject them to common institutions. So rather than having ministers from six countries deciding matters as ministers from six countries, There you have established a council which brings the ministers together, a commission, an executive arm, and at the time, of course, a parliamentary assembly, a consultative assembly, then still composed of delegates from national parliaments. Well, this was the idea, and the idea was to start by concretely working together on initially coal and steel, eventually with the economic community, of course, the common market, the idea of bringing together the markets and to remove barriers between the markets, between the member states. Well, by so doing, this would manage to establish what Robert Schuman, initially in his famous Schuman Declaration of the 9th of May, said, a de facto solidarity between the peoples of Europe. So, by taking practical measures, one would establish a solidarity which would go much deeper then, and the creation of a European consciousness, a sense of belonging to not just, let us keep in mind that in Europe the notion of the nation state is quite strong, is very strong. So, particularly, I mean, in view of the two world wars that were fought during the last century. So it was, in a way, not just a question of doing things together just to reap economic benefits, but the idea was to bring peace, stability, and this would lead to prosperity between the peoples, allowing peoples in countries which were less developed than other countries to improve their standard of living, their condition of living, their economic prosperity. And this is what happened. I mean, look at the first six the founding members of the European Community, now the European Union, and you have six of the best economies in Europe. Now, this process obviously was extended. Why? Because six countries then in Western Europe, and one can see also the parallels, you know, how things proceeded, even with eventually when the Soviet Union collapsed and the countries then behind the so-called Iron Curtain were liberated and adopted a democratic form of government, they moved towards joining such a community, this union. Therefore, you had the six then becoming nine with Ireland, United Kingdom and Denmark, eventually Greece, then Spain and Portugal, and the further enlargement then the Scandinavian countries and Austria, until, of course, the enlargement in 2004 of the 10 member states, including Malta, and a few years later, Bulgaria and Romania. Well, this was it. I mean, having a community where indeed things are done together, but where more than anything else, one would try to without trying to bring about, you know, a harmonization of cultures or of peoples, you know, bringing everything the same, a standardization. This is something which people fear sometimes from the European Union. You know, who does it want to create standards that suppress legitimate diversities between peoples? No, that is not the idea. The idea is to, in fact, the motto of the European Union being united in diversity. So, can this be extended further? And this is the point we are considering. What about the countries that are applying, that countries that wish to join? Well, as we know, there are a number of countries which are candidate countries, and there are a number of countries which are potential candidates. So you have among the candidate countries, you have Croatia, Iceland, Montenegro, former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia, and Turkey. And then you have other countries in the Western Balkans which are potential candidates, Albania, Bosnia and Herzegovina, Serbia and Kosovo. So these are the potential candidates. But with the candidate countries, you already have countries which are negotiating accession. So Croatia being the most advanced. Of course, one expects that the Croatian date, I was reading, I think today or yesterday, that the date for Croatia's accession is expected to be established pretty soon. Then you have the question of Turkey. And the problem this represents for certain people, whether Turkey, with its diverse culture and the traditions, could be integrated into this European Union. Well, the European Union, the membership of the European Union is open to European democratic countries. The criteria are that the country must be European and respect the principles of liberty, democracy, respect for human rights and fundamental freedoms, and rule of law. Once these criteria are there, then no country can be refused membership. So I think, well, this is not, in the case of Turkey, I do not believe it is a question of cultural identity, but a question of, does the country fulfill these criteria? So other considerations, I think, within the pluralist European context, that we live in, and the cultural diversity, I do not think it is so significant. If you go in many of the Western European countries, there is much cultural diversity, much religious diversity. So I do not believe that cultural or religious grounds which are not criteria for membership of the European Union should be brought into play. I believe that the choice should be solely on the basis of, is the country ready for membership? Does it fulfill the conditions? Once that answer is replied to in the affirmative, then all doors should be open for any country, including Turkey, to join the European Union.
Thank you, Dr. Van Nishwire, for your input. Back in the studios, the debate continues with Christian Tanti and Stefan Darmanin, who are our students for today, and they're discussing the process of EU integration. Christian, when mentioning trade and economics, what is that factor, according to your view, that triggers EU integration amongst the different nations?
Yes, also apart from the fact of the Schengen Agreement, which we mentioned first, another factor is the common strong currency among member states, and obviously you're referring to the euro here. Basically, thanks to the euro, the European Union can compete even with the other big two, which are the Japanese yen and the American dollar, which are two strong currencies in the international scene. Also, thanks to euro, transaction costs are eliminated when people are moving from a country to another, obviously within the EU. Profitability firms.
Okay, knowing that the European Union is one of the most proactive entities that work towards a better environment, how does this trigger member states to integrate fully within this context?
Yes, also here we are, one can say that the EU is one of the most proactive entities that works towards the environment. Also, one have to say that the environment knows no border, and so the only effective way to tackle environmental pollution is through international cooperation rather than domestic policies and action as well on international basis. An example of this regarding a member state of the European Union can be the case of Britain, which one can say that if it wasn't for the European Union itself, Britain wouldn't have cleaner water or cleaner air and cleaner beaches if it wasn't for the action taken by the European Union level.
And certainly this topic that we were discussing today, the process of EU integration, has been interesting, hopefully even to our listeners. Christian and Stefan, I thank you very much for joining us. We hope that we speak with you again in our future shows. Today we're discussing EU integration on It's Debatable. Remember that you can join by posting your questions and comments on our online forum, that is mirsa.org.mt. It's Debatable is a conjoint initiative between the Department of International Relations within the University of Malta and Mirsa, the Malta International Relations Student Association. A special thank you goes to Dr. Isabel Kaleja, who is the head of the International Relations Department, and the lecturer, Dr. Ms. Valentina Kassar and Ms. Joyce Gregg, for their input. Our special guest for today was Dr. Van Nishwire, who heads the Malta EU Steering and Action Committee, commonly referred to as MUSEC. On the next show next week, we shall be discussing minority rights, and I will have with me in the studios international relations students Martina Portelli and Mikhail Pisani. Aydarin Katkuti, thank you, our dear listeners, for joining us today. I invite you to stay tuned to Campus FM.